And our special guest this hour, Richard Dolan, UFOs in the National Security State. We'll be back with Richard in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And they keep rolling in. Now we have Richard Dolan, UFO researcher. Richard Dolan holding an MA degree from the University of Rochester, BA from Alfred University. Richard has now followed up with Volume 2 of his UFOs in the National Security State. And there's more coming, I'm sure. Richard Dolan on Coast to Coast AM. Hey, Richard, how are you?
Hi, George. Hey, it's great to be on your show again.
Always a pleasure. This is an interesting conference. I hope one day the politicians squeeze people and we get disclosure.
Yes. Yes. This is a discussion that many of us have had for a long time. It's like a disclosure family. My very close friend Stephen Bassett, and I know you've had Alfred Weber on just a little
Bryant
while ago.
And all those people, I bet, huh?
You know, the question is how and when, not if. I think there's going to be something that's going to happen. The question is how soon will it be, and under what conditions will it happen? I've been one of these people where I firmly believe that we need to have openness on the UFO issue. You know, people can only be spoon-fed lies for so long.
Right.
And we've had this going on in our society for such a long time. So I think we deserve the truth. And it does matter if our government is truthful with us or not on this issue. The real question is, will it happen in the very near future, or are we going to have to wait a while? And I've been of the opinion that we're going to have to wait a while. I'm just not seeing it happen in the Obama administration.
You.
Do
I
you?
Agree with you. Unlike Steve Bassett believes it's going to happen soon.
Yes, he does.
I don't believe it. You know, Stephen, God love him, is one of the hardest workers in this field, but he's so optimistic that we're going to get disclosure with the right political party. He's been saying this since 1997.
Yeah. I got
it's 12 years now.
I got dipped into this conversation, I think, in 01, 02. I remember chatting with Stephen in I think it was 02, and he said the Bush administration is going to do this. And I said, what are you smoking, man? This is not going to happen. He said, no, it's going to happen because they want to be the disclosure party. It's going to – it'll ensconce them in power for the next generation or two. They'll want to do it. They just have to find the right way to do it. And I said, well, I beg to differ.
And you were right.
Well, I didn't want to be right. I didn't want to be. But the problem that I keep finding is that if we're going to get disclosure, we have to ask disclosure from whom? Is it going to be the president? Who's in charge here? Who's running this show? I've just finished the next book in my study of UFOs in the National Security State. And this covers the 1970s and 1980s up to the end of the Cold War in 1991. And one of the things I've tried to understand is, you know, what is the structure of secrecy? How does this whole thing work out? Is it something that the United States president is in charge?
Or not?
And I think the answer is, I mean, a little bit, but mostly no. I think mostly presidents, they're placed in power by powerful interests who stand behind them, financial interests, and I think they're global in nature. And we can see this when you step away from the UFO topic. You can see, for example, the current stimulus package right now that President Obama is promoting. This was a package that was organized under the Bush administration. Mm-hmm. A little baby that George Bush gave to Obama. Obama kissed this baby and said, this is my baby and I want you
it
to...
ran with.
That's right. And so, you know, where's the independence here? When the G20 was meeting in Switzerland a few months ago, the head of the Carlyle Equity Group said, well, this Buy American clause in the stimulus package, that won't fly. That's just a lot of steam for politicians to vent. Now, if you were the president, you might take offense at that. What actually happened was a few hours later, the Obama administration said, we'll need to revisit that part of the stimulus package.
Ugh.
That's right. So all I'm saying here is, who's in charge?
Who's in charge?
And when we come to the matter of UFOs and disclosure, it's the same thing. My study into this has convinced me that there's a transnational or metanational group. They're not really fully and formally part of the U.S. government, not in my view.
Though some of them could be Americans.
Absolutely. And I'm not saying that the U.S. military has nothing to do with this, but I think the problem has gone so black, it's so off the grid, as it were, that I'm not convinced they're really part of a formal U.S. government system. And if that's the case, then I think it would probably take a little bit more than a statement from the president to release people from their oaths and to talk about this.
Richard, isn't it fascinating? Here we are in the city, in the area, where in 1952, UFOs buzzed the White House.
That's right. For a couple of weekends in a row, they flew over the Capitol building. They were photographed. They were seen on radar. We have a lot of statements. There are a few people still alive to this day who continue to speak about this. Not only that, then 50 years after that in 2002, there was another astonishing series of sightings just outside D.C. by quite a few witnesses in which two F-16s were seen chasing this blue object, whatever it was. This is post 9/11 America. Mm-hmm. What was this?
And could not catch them.
No, they absolutely could not. The object, according to one of the witnesses I spoke with, descended at an 80-degree angle from the sky and then stopped while the F-16s turned around to pursue this thing, and the object, or whatever it was, just took off, shoom, gone. You'd hate to be the Air Force spokesperson regarding that, because what he said the next day is, well, yes, we did chase something, but, well, it could have been any number of things. And, of course, what you want to know is, really, well, what things could this have been? I'd like to know. What blue object can outperform F-16s post 9/11 America right outside restricted airspace of D.C.?
And you can't do anything about it?
Other than on places like this station, coast to coast. The large media, they just let it go. They just let it go. And I wonder, what is going on? Why don't they touch this story? Forget the alien connection. Just what is what is this thing that can outperform our top military fighters in our own airspace? And what is this lack of curiosity by the major media?
Over the last year, there have been a lot of incredible UFO stories, but two that come to mind, Richard, the UK pilots and some of the passengers who saw a huge object. He estimated a mile long. That's big.
Oh, yes, over in, by the Channel Islands, yeah. I believe.
And then
right,
there
yes.
was that other story of right. the U.S. pilot who at the time near Britain
yeah.
says that he was told to fire on them.
This is the Milton Torres case.
Yeah.
Yes.
Both of these are incredible stories.
I just had the pleasure today to meet Milton Torres. He's here in Washington.
Is he at the X Conference?
He is at the X Conference. He's here.
Didn't know that.
Milton Torres. He's a straightforward guy, and
well, how old is he now?
I don't know. He looks very youthful. I have to say, he doesn't look like he's 80. He's got to be younger than that. Maybe
look older than Tom.
About similar age. Yeah. About you know how old Tom is? What, 68, 69?
68, 70.
Yeah, I thought so.
Like
right. Sorry, Tom.
Tom gets a speaking part for the first time in his life.
24.
Tom's great. Milton Torres described, I almost feel bad saying this, but he said, I felt like a one-legged man in an ass-kicking contest in chasing this. I hope I can say that.
Well, at this hour, you can.
Good. Okay,
normally,
great.
I'd blip you.
he was ordered to fire on this object and was totally outclassed. This is in the late 1950s.
And he said it was just so fast, he could not keep up with it.
Right.
There was no technology then. If we had that kind of technology, would we not have used it?
Well, I don't know anymore.
So you think that's possible?
Ten years.
We're hiding incredible technology, and we're just not using it.
I think it's possible. Here's why I think it's possible. I think...
push a button, every terrorist goes away. We could do that right now, couldn't we?
I'm not sure that the... the off-the-grid military. I'm starting to think that what we may have.
As Richard Hoagland says, two distinct organizations.
Yes, this is what I think. And I've started to think about a concept that I'm starting to call a breakaway civilization. And I'm really starting to think that this may be the case. I mean, just imagine that you have, all right, that you're in the classified world and you've acquired some exotic technology back in the 1940s. and you have your brilliant scientists work on it long enough, and they come up with this great idea. And they, let's say they don't want to share it right away.
With anybody.
With anybody. And they think, well, let's keep developing it and developing, and that great idea leads to another great idea, which leads to another and another. I mean, in our own history, we've had many, many examples of civilizations with totally different levels of infrastructure. You know, when Europe was traveling around the world in the 16th century and 17th century, well, their shipbuilding infrastructure and their science was well ahead of every other nation on Earth. During the Cold War, America and the Soviet Union had equal but very different types of scientific infrastructures, and they didn't always share what they knew. So it's really not an unusual idea when you think about it. And I think it's quite possible, quite likely, frankly, that within the deep black classified world, that breakthroughs could have been made that were not shared with the rest of us, and that after a certain period of time, it could have led to radically different technologies. And if that's so, could it be such to the extent that their fundamental technology and science and what they know is so different that we might call it a different civilization.
And money's kept getting filtered to it.
Well, when you have basically an infinite amount of money to play with and total secrecy, then, yeah, I think this is possible. And so if the technology exists, it might not necessarily be in the arsenals of the United States military. And so the U.S., the formal military, quite possibly wouldn't have access to this, and that's why these wars go on forever and ever.
Under somebody's control.
If there's an ET phenomenon, if you have a variety of non-human groups that are here, it's quite possible that you might want to reserve that technology for use in dealing with them, not necessarily the, you know, the ordinary guys.
It's also,
right?
You ever play poker?
Yeah, sometimes.
Okay.
I enjoy it.
Sometimes you don't pull out all your great hand at that time. You kind of bluff a while, right?
Right.
You know you've got a strong hand. You probably know you have a winning hand, but you don't raise it. You let them do it.
You call.
You just make them think that you're weak. I'm wondering if that's their philosophy, that they've got it, they know they have it, they could use it any time they want to obliterate nations and civilizations. They just don't want to use it right now.
They meaning the like the classified world.
Exactly. That second group.
Right.
Because they don't have any need to yet.
They certainly wouldn't have a need to, yes, against other nations because of maybe America's conventional military superiority.
They're still stronger. Right.
But I would suspect that it could be that what they've developed just might be so exotic that they feel they can't reveal it without giving some important secret away that might allow other nations then to catch up on it. So that, I mean, really, if there's a large number of ETs that are here or that are interested in our world, and I'm coming to the conclusion that that's the case, then it seems to me that you might need or you might feel that you need a totally separate infrastructure to deal with that.
True.
So this is simply a theory that I'm working on. Or work with them, exactly. Yeah, not always necessarily in a confrontational way. Who knows?
These large triangular-shaped objects that so many people are reporting seeing, right, including police officers, right, are they ours?
Well, I've gone back and forth on this myself. I did a long study of the triangles a couple of years ago and tried to figure this out. I think it's quite possible that we've made these triangles. However, I think it's entirely possible that some of them are not ours. Just because a triangle looks more conventional than, say, a flying saucer doesn't mean that we've made them all. However,
we could have made them based on ET craft,
exactly,
right?
Exactly. Although I think there are triangular craft that I think we've almost certainly been making. The famous Black Manta, I think, is one such. Even back 20 years ago, there were leaks coming out of the aviation community, reported in Aviation Weekly, Aviation Journal, describing, you know, triangular aircraft that were being tested out of Groom Lake. And
big ones, too.
That's right. Large and small, but some very massive ones. So I suspect that that's true. I suspect we've been making them.
Anti-gravity?
My opinion, I'm speaking as a non-scientist working historically and journalistically, getting leaks, I think, yes. I think that anti-gravity has been achieved. And then the question keeps coming down to, well, why are they, as you just asked, why are they not being used in these wars? I mean, we're fighting all these wars, losing all this money. presumably something like that would end them, unless you felt that what they're being used for is so critically important that they can't be used for anything else.
Or maybe they don't want to end war.
I mean, look, you know, we're watching some night vision acrobatics in the sky.
Yeah,
you know,
two of them.
Not
bizarre.
Long ago. Absolutely, and you know, what if it's possible that what you were seeing was absolutely real, and that there's a kind of unknown Cold War going on right now? I mean, what if? I think it's quite possible, and so that the technologies that have been developed secretly would be used in that context, and maybe only that context. It could be that it's so compartmented, it's so focused on this one mission that it wouldn't be allowed to be used for more conventional missions.
Isn't it amazing how people like you have come up with some conclusions that could be so very, very true to the truth?
Well, you know,
wouldn't you like to have some guy sit you down and say, Richard, come here.
Right.
You know, I work for so-and-so, and this is the agency we're with, and I've been doing it for 20 years, and I want to tell you something. This is what we have. And
right.
You're absolutely correct. We've been doing it. This is where we keep them. We've had ET help.
Yeah.
Would you fall off your chair?
Well, no, because it's the kind of thing has happened, George. I've spoken now with a number of individuals who show me credentials. They look legitimate, mostly, and who tell me some amazing stories. And like anyone who's been in this field long enough, you can't vet everyone. It's just not possible. Some people come and they tell you what they want to tell you, and that's that.
We're still waiting for films by, for example, from an individual who called us, mm-hmm. who claims that he's in Europe now, who says he has films, old black and white,
President Eisenhower, right? Yes,
and Howard Hughes witnessing craft and ETs.
This is making the rounds.
This is all over the place. Yeah, I don't know if this guy's real or not. Tom talks to him. Tom emails him.
Uh-huh.
Is he real, Tom?
I haven't heard back from him yet.
So who knows?
Right. No, that's quite interesting, isn't it?
How long do you stay in Europe and hide? You don't say, I'm not back yet.
Right.
Come on. You called my show 2 months ago.
Yeah, I mean, there's just so many stories out there. And
But you can't talk to them, and I've talked to them.
Someone wants to talk to me. At every conference, they all are like the X conferences in particular, because we're in the D.C. area, and there's a lot of military people. They live right in the area, and they come to these conferences, and they talk. And there's people here this weekend, same type of thing. And I have been told stories that, I mean, they're extraordinary. And I have been told that we have fleets of these things. I've been told that we go off-world. I can't prove it. I've been told this by a number of individuals, and all you can do is put it in the so-called gray basket and continue to look for leads. It's like the on the TV show Law and Order.
Mm-hmm.
I don't watch it much anymore, but I was a fan. And you know how, like, when Jack McCoy, the DA, he's got this guy. He knows that this guy did it. Unfortunately, the evidence is not admissible.
It's not there.
Okay.
Right.
And so now he's got to find another way to reach his goal. And I think in a lot of ways, we're kind of in that boat. You get evidence that's not really admissible. So now you've got to find another way to get to this and find out what you need to find out.
That's when you send the cleaner to take care of your problems.
The cleaner. Oh, boy.
You know, can't get the evidence. Let the cleaner take care of things.
Right.
When's the new book out?
Anytime now. I've actually finished the writing of this. This is volume 2 of the UFOs in the National Security State. I've subtitled it The Cover-Up Exposed.
And when you write, you write. How many pages
It's about 600 pages, I think. I have to finish the pagination, but that's about right. The index has to be done, and I have to finish the conclusion. I've got a number of readers looking at this book, and I will say, I think 2 months, it'll be ready. The readers are getting very excited. I've had a few people just telling me they love it.
Good for you. We'll be back in a moment. Interactive. We'll take your phone calls with Richard Dolan next on Coast to Coast AM. Indeed, with our special guest, Richard Dolan. We'll be back in a moment. The phone lines are now open. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie. It's our final segment now of our special report here in Washington, D.C. at the X Conference with our guest, Richard Dolan, and your phone calls. as well. Richard, in everything you've investigated, everything over all these years, is there one compelling case that you would have to say was the best ever?
Oh, my God.
That you read, looked at, heard about?
Well,
the best.
With best, you have to look into all these different factors. I mean, the quality of the case itself, the quality of the witnesses, and the quality of the documentation. I would say one that immediately came to mind is probably the famous 1976 jet chase over Tehran, September 76. The reason I think it's a great case is, A, you've got this incredible object that was seen by thousands of residents of the city of Tehran. Then you have two F-4 fighter interceptors in a row trying to get this thing. Both had their communications electronics zapped out at 25 nautical miles.
I think we had the general on the air.
I was just going to say, right, one of those pilots became a general, and he's talked at length about it. We also have defense support program satellites that tracked an anomalous object exactly there at that time and place. And so you've got all these different types of confirmations of this extraordinary event. I mean, this object completely outperformed F-4 fighter interceptors. It actually detached this thing, whatever it was, and went on an intercept of one of the aircraft. Scared the heck out of the pilot. Yes, exactly.
Gotta watch what you say.
Yeah, I do. I gotta watch that. But it's an extraordinary case. There's no explanation to this day over what could possibly do that. So that's the top off the top of my head when I would say.
All right, to the phones we go. Let us go east of the Rockies. Alan, it's your turn. Where are you calling from, Alan?
Oh, just outside Fort Detrick, Maryland.
There you are. Okay. Go ahead, Al.
I'd like to ask Mr. Dolan about the economic impact of disclosure and if that's the real reason that it hasn't been disclosed over the last 60 years.
Yes, excellent question, Alan. And I've often argued that I think that's one of the key reasons that disclosure hasn't happened. For example, I mean, what if the answers to this phenomenon involve, you know, let's say the ETs have a better version of steel than what we make, or a better version of oil than what we have. So what happens to those industries? In the long term, well, this could be great for human civilization, no doubt about it. But in the short term, it would have possibly disastrous financial impact. Or how about this? What if part of the answer to this involves something to do with time? You know, is there an ability for these other beings to manipulate space-time or time itself in some way? There's a lot of people who think that's possible. If that's so, what would that do to, I don't know, the stock market? Well, it might be great if one or two people can predict the future, but if everyone can, poof, there goes the stock market. That sounds crazy, but maybe not so. I think, and then you get into black budget issues. I think there's been a lot of missing money over the course of history in the last decade or two in this country. And once this comes out, I have a feeling a lot of angry people would be in front of the White House demanding to know where trillions of dollars have gone missing into these possibly UFO technology type programs.
I don't know, Richard. They're not doing it now on the stimulus money.
That's a good point, George. Nevertheless, I think if it came out, I think there is potential for lawsuits, potential. I wouldn't underestimate the anger that people could have at being lied to over 50, 60 years. I think I wouldn't underestimate it anyway. So, but yes, there's a lot of economic effects that could be as a result of disclosure. And it's come to me from more than one source, actually, that this issue comes up at high levels every few years or so, every 5-10 years. And one of the things that they are concerned about would be economic ramifications.
Those who do not believe that we're being visited. Carl Sagan was one of them, though he believed in extraterrestrial life.
Mm-hmm.
Seth Shostak from SETI believes in extraterrestrial life, but doesn't believe we're being visited. Why do the skeptics feel the way they do?
Well, one of the reasons I hear these people talk, and I get the distinct idea that they've never read a single UFO report in their life. I don't know about Carl Sagan, but a lot of these skeptics, I'm continually astonished, George, at the lack of investigation some of these people have done. It's as if, oh, well, I don't think it's possible, therefore it's impossible. Well, UFOs sound impossible, don't they? Guys from somewhere else coming all the way over here.
Sure.
Well, sure, it sounds impossible, but the problem is, start reading a few hundred military reports detailing this impossible thing that's been going on.
Or how about sailors who have seen craft
Absolutely.
Emerge out of the ocean?
Exactly.
Those are incredible.
How many of these? That's right. A lot of USOs, you know, underwater submersible, unidentified submersible objects. So you can dismiss one or two or three or ten of them, I suppose, but what about a couple of hundred? I mean, at a certain point, you know, you have to look at these and say there's something impossible going on here. It demands our attention. What I find is that it's very typical. Once someone gets to a certain age, I think we tend to solidify our belief system, and we just say, that's it. I'm not changing anymore. There are always exceptions to that rule, but I think, unfortunately, there are a lot of people, they get set in their ways, and they don't want to hear anything different.
Let's go to Stockton, California, west of the Rockies. Hey, John, you're on with Richard Dolan.
Well, my uncle was in NASA, and he says what Star Trek has, they would envy what they had in Area 51, and they already had a space alliance. And when we were in the service in a Nike base in Pittsburgh, and I was on guard. My buddy was a dog handler, and he come running in there scared. And I knew he seen something because I seen a big one when I was young. And I run out there and I'm looking, and it was gone. So I come in there and he's gone. You see it? And so we told the guys up at the ISC, the radar. He says, you and your buddy come on up tonight, and we'll show you something. So we were in there and they had these big scopes in there, and they cover the whole northern hemisphere. Okay, just a second. I can put the phone down. The cops was next to me. Hold on.
In California, it is illegal to talk on the phone in your hand.
We were sitting in there, and it was real dark, and then almost he said, here they come. They're coming over the North Pole. He says, oh, they're not ours. And they've had them clocked up to 10,000 miles an hour. And he says they've been to every one of our missile bases.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, John, that's fascinating. And there have been journalists, even back in the early, mid-1980s, who were developing sources inside Groom Lake. This is before the world even heard of Bob Lazar. It came out that, yes, we have things in the Nevada desert that would make George Lucas envious, and things of this particular sort, better than Star Trek, better than anything like that. So there's a lot of smoke out there, and I think that signifies some fire. And as far as, you know, some of these things are ours and some of these things are not ours, as you were saying yourself. I think that's right.
Yeah, my buddy saw his friend saw the big triangle that was in Phoenix. And
sure.
He missed it. Oh, is he mad? Because there's so many people saw that night, and they try to cover it up. There was, helicopters flying in formation.
Oh, yeah, there's all kinds of explanations. Even to this day, they're coming up with new things.
Yeah.
You know, aircraft in formation is the latest one that I heard, and I thought, my God, really?
Thanks.
Okay, John, thanks. Appreciate your being on the program. Some of these incredible events that happen all the time. Do you document a lot of these?
I do. I speak with people privately on a fairly frequent basis, and I don't document every single story I get, but I try to document a lot of them. And what I find is that people, they go through life, and they'll have this extraordinary sighting. And the scary thing to me is that they almost tell nobody about it. Maybe a couple of friends.
That's
maybe
because they're going to get ridiculed.
Exactly. So, I mean, think about how significant this is. The most amazing thing that you may see in your entire life, and you tell nobody. We're dealing with this incredible phenomenon in an atomized, isolated way. I don't think that's a good way. You know, once upon a time, we had a Project Blue Book, so that back in the old days, in the 1950s and 60s, if you saw something that you thought was strange, well, you could at least report it to your Air Force. Not that they would do anything about it, but at least you as a citizen could have closure on the event. You'd figure, well, my government's looking at it.
Or at least think you did.
Right. And there's nothing like that. I mean, there's website. You can go to the UFO Reporting Center, but it's just all private, unofficial.
There's nothing official.
People don't have a place to go, and I think that's a problem.
Yeah. That's true. Good point. Let's go to Illinois. That's where we're going right now. First-time caller, Joel, you're up with us on Coast to Coast. Hi, Joel.
Good. Hey, how are you doing today?
We're well.
Great.
Thanks.
Listen, I just want to get straight to the point. Earlier you had mentioned how is it feasible that we would have a more advanced technology and actually sit on it, not use it, even though it could be effective to use. You know, that's documented. We've had that happen in that's well known. The F-117 stealth fighter. Mm-hmm. We actually had that aircraft available in operation for use when we had the Libyan raid.
That's right. Yeah, it was operational back from the early 80s, and during the Libyan raid, it it was not used. Is that right?
That's correct. And they used F-111s instead, but because they just didn't want the world to know they had that technology yet. So I think
interesting.
We could be sitting on all kinds of things. And you know, it's hard to believe that our aircraft design stopped in the 80s or stopped with the stealth bomber. I'm sure that we've gone on to bigger and better things.
I think that's a great point, Joel.
All right, thanks, Joel. Let's go to Canada. Lynn, your turn on Coast to Coast. Hi, Lynn.
Hi. I am so glad your station tells the truth. Believe me.
We try. You're the
only one who does. Richard, a long time ago, my uncle told a story that him and his friends were playing, and this is in Western Canada, and they're jumping on big rocks. Mm-hmm. And he was thrown and his friends on this one. It scared them that they left it. And I always wondered, I thought, what, you know, was wrong with this big rock that would force that would throw them? Well, now that Coral Castle, like Leonard Litskillen, who was a simple nobody, how did he have this technology of anti-gravitational? Like, it bewilders me because I know now the rocks that my uncle, this is going 65, 70 years ago,
yes,
was, you know, energized.
So you're saying they flew off the rock somehow, or they?
Yes, they did. They went to jump.
Propelled
on it,
off of it.
And they went boom, like you said. Threw them right off fast. Now those that they had to have been magnetized, and maybe just somebody left them there in the open prairie and thought, who cares? Who's going to know?
And now Coral Castle's. I'm sorry. Go on.
I was going to say now we know with Coral Castle, and you know their investigations, that he had the knowledge and technology of, you know, gravitational lifts.
She sure did, and magnetics, and once said that he knew the secrets of how the pyramids were built.
Right. Well,
this guy was 120 pounds.
It's an that is an amazing, amazing feat, is Coral Castle. So so there's this place in Western Canada then, Lynn, that has similar types of properties.
It's amazing.
Wow. Thank you.
Coral Castle, though, is a great story. I mean, a great story. Edward Leet Skolnin, 120 pounds, moving blocks as big as some of the pyramid blocks.
Right, exactly.
All by himself.
Yeah, that's extraordinary.
And when anybody would come peek at what he was doing, he'd stop working. He didn't want them to see what he was doing.
And he, I know he's passed away.
Yeah,
right?
he's gone.
So now, did the whole thing, did this come out after he died, or were people visiting
him
during his lifetime?
People were visiting him during the lifetime. There was one interesting story, Richard, where he had to move. He was somewhat roughed up by some of the neighborhood people physically. And so he moved from one area of Florida to Homestead, Florida.
Oh, and he moved the castle, didn't he?
He moved the castle. He hired a flatbed truck driver to come up, and he said, you go away, just leave your truck here, and I'll have it loaded by the time you come back.
Oh, my God.
And the truck driver comes back, and these blocks, these huge blocks, are on this flatbed truck. And he couldn't.
And there's, no equipment, anything like that was obvious where he could have.
Yeah, and off he went. Yeah, he had something in the area there that looked like it was some kind of huge magneto. And a lot of the parts are gone. Maybe people broke in and stole it since.
Okay.
The guy knew magnets, and he once wrote in a small pamphlet book, which I have, that every object can be magnetized. It doesn't have to be metal.
Okay.
And I think he knew something.
It sounds like a
secret.
That's fascinating.
Back to the phones we go. Let's go to Ray in Austin, Texas, one of our favorite cities. Hey, Ray, go ahead.
Hey, George, how are you doing?
Good.
First caller as well. I've tried for a couple of years to try to get through, but it's so hard to get through.
Yeah, it is, but I'm glad you made it. Go ahead.
Anyway, I met you in Austin, Texas with Alex Jones. You actually wanted to get a hold of me and talk to me, but you've never gotten my number. If you want, I'll give it to you at the end of the talk here.
Yeah, I'll put you on hold, and Gina back in LA will do it for you.
I talked to you about the TR-3B. I was in the military in USAP. I think I told you about that. Beyond that, one of the reasons I'm calling is ever since I was 9, I've had abductions every 4 years of my life. One of the abductions at 19, I was always scared of them, but at 19, I asked them, you know, why are y'all doing this? And I'll never forget his words. He said, if you knew of an island of rabbits and you knew this island was going to sink, but you have the technology and the capability to save some of these rabbits, wouldn't you do so?
Mm-hmm. Oh, boy.
At that point, I knew mm-hmm. what they were doing. I knew that everything was, that they were good. And for everyone who has been abducted out there, I don't have to tell you this. You already know that we're going. You're going.
That's
you know
a good
that.
Point.
I don't have to tell you that. So with everything that's going on, we all know what's getting ready to happen. Something really big's getting ready to happen.
With non-humans to a different place, or I mean, what do you think?
It's kind of like a Noah's Ark type thing.
Okay.
You go, Richard?
If the Earth were sinking into the sea, yes.
You take your wife and you'd go.
I would do that.
You wouldn't leave her?
No.
Of course not.
No, I would not.
You guys get along well. You've got good chemistry there. I don't know if I'd go.
Really?
No, not if I knew you were going. I'm kidding. Gosh, time is almost up.
That was a fascinating call, by the way.
Yeah.
Really everyone. Yeah.
And Ray, I'm putting you on hold. Gina back in L.A. Get his phone number. Put it on my desk. I'll be back in Los Angeles in 1 week. Heading back to St. Louis for my daughter's birthday. I'll do my shows there for one more week. And then it's back to La La Land. We'll do that. Richard, we're almost out of time.
Wow.
People want information on you. What do they do?
Go to my website. It's keyholepublishing.com, just like looking through a keyhole, keyholepublishing.com. There's information on the new book coming out. It's not out right now, but it will be out probably, I think, in print within 2 months. I'm finishing it now.
Give me your views of, like, the X conference. Do you think these kinds of conferences are necessary, important?
I think all conferences provide a service, if for nothing else, than to allow speakers and researchers to meet with each other and share ideas. It's important in terms of the research, because otherwise, there's email and there's conversation, but when you actually meet with somebody in person, it makes a difference. I think it's important for those in the research to build relationships. Beyond that, I think, you know, what we're doing is planting seeds. Not all of them are obvious immediately, but some of them do germinate. And there's a lot of fascinating people who come to these conferences, and they are frequently affected in a very personal way by what's going on.
Steve Bassett, who puts this on, is a very driven person.
Yes, he is. And that's the kind of person you need to run conferences like this. And he's in for the long haul. You need a dedicated, almost fanatically persevering kind of person who's going to make it. Look at the people who've made a difference in this world. I mean, they've all been driven people who know that they have a mission, and against all odds, they, you know, follow their quest, their vision, and they eventually, if they're lucky, the dice roll the right way, they make things happen.
Last year at the conference, I told a Steve Batzer story when I first had him on my show in St. Louis at the time. I asked him one question. He started answering it, and I realized that he was going to answer it for so long I could leave the room and come back an hour later. I did. Richard, thanks so much.
My pleasure, George. Thank you.
And thanks to Dan Galante, Gina Yates, David Sproul here at WMAL, Dan Galante, and Roseanne Burroughs, Rihanna Burroughs, who made all this possible. Coast to Coast continues in a moment.